How we are? Oh, we rewind, man. Oh, oh, that's gone off again. Stop it now.
There we are.
That's better.
It wouldn't be Zoom without an issue.
We've got quite good, though, David, to be fair, haven't we?
We have.
David, wait a minute. Give me, like, count to 10. Go!
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Oh, man.
11, 12.
I could hear somebody at the door. I've just let the dog out and I've shouted to Ian to take him.
Jane, you know how your weekly sweats about who does the intro and everything?
Yeah.
Well, we don't have to worry about that this week because it's in the capable hands of Mr. David Goodall, everybody.
Yay!
Is it really?
Don't run into the ground.
No, okay. I'll try not to. Well, yeah, excellent. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 9 of Theatre One Across. Today's episode is Doctor Knows Best.
David.
Jane.
I think you should do that with an accent. Uh-huh. Oh, Doctor Knows Best. Doctor Knows Best.
I did it with an accent.
Oh.
My own accent.
Oh.
Well, I quite liked it, but I preferred Octopussy.
Yeah, Doctor Knows Best.
Was Octopussy the one where he inverted the plane and flew it through a hangar?
That was the one with the lotus and went under the water as well, wasn't it?
No, I thought that was the spy who loved me. To whom it may
I've got a 15-year-old who's ended old to me. This is last night. The only bad thing about lockdown, Mum, is that the James Bond film isn't out yet at the pictures. Only bad thing about it.
A lot of people saying that.
It's his last one as well, isn't it?
Aye.
Right, well, never say never.
Oh, yes. Get in.
Come on.
Get in there.
Nearly clapped there, David, but you told me not to clap.
No. Yeah, that was very sore.
David, what's your feeling about the topic for this week then?
I'm quite enjoying the topic. I think we should say it's not about saying that doctors are pish. It's actually about experts in general and how sometimes they do mess up. And sometimes, though, we also don't listen to their advice.
Uh-huh.
Could be a plumber, could be a doctor, could be anyone that tells you what to do. And, you know, the number of times that we go, no, my mate actually says, or I read on Google. And yet, the number of times that we do that and we're right. I think we've all got tales of horror, be it from doctors or whomever. It's about the weight we put on the advice of experts. Obviously, you had Michael Gove, the thinking man's Beaker the Muppet, saying back during the Brexit thing that we're all tired of experts, and now they're desperately trying to pin every mistake about coronavirus onto the experts.
It's shameful, really, to be honest with you, that. But no, I think you're right. Advice in general. I remember a really good quote from a wee man from Croy. I don't know if you know him. His name's Fergus McCann, right? He came over from Canada and saved Celtic, and he famously went into a taxi one time. And the taxi driver asked him how he was enjoying his time in Glasgow, and he just said, "Too much free advice."
Yeah, that's about right.
I was always listening to a doctor, to be honest. You know, I would always take advice from a doctor. And I remember, this would have been 1980. I'm 9. I've got a cyst just at my arse. It would not go away. Up and down, red cyst, blah, blah, blah. So I goes to the Shettleston Health Centre at the time, Shettleston Road, with my mum. He sat outside, just sit there, and Mark kind of sits down. Okay. Going in and see, and it was Dr. Devine. So this is 1980, Dr. Devine. I walks right up to the back of the surgery. I goes in and she says, "Hello, Mark, how are you?" And she finishes the last draw on her capstan. And I always remember the two packets sitting on the desk. I initially thought, she's going to put this fag out in my arse to get rid of this.
I can remember smoking on flights as well. Do you remember that?
There was a smoking section. Anything more pointless than a smoking section in a plane?
We had it in restaurants as well. Yeah. And smoke would obviously get to the non-smoking bit and turn back. Because it was very obedient like that smoke. Ridiculous.
I always trust... I don't, that's a lie. I do trust doctors, but I mean, it's a pinch of salt. The number of times I've been prescribed medication for things for which there was absolutely no reason whatsoever... Go see someone else and they're like, "Don't take those. Why would you take those?" Second opinions. Every bit of drama, you kind of see, you know, there's someone going, "I want a second opinion." Yeah. How do you really, could you really say to your doctor, I want a second opinion. Would you have the guts to do that?
Would you get that on the NHS, or would they say you would have to go and...
You need to wait for a second opinion. They would say a second opinion about what?
Before you go, I know.
You've got herpes. It's a fact. That's it.
We're lucky because as actors, David, we've got many, many friends that have done medical role play.
And they can give you many opinions.
If you can't get an appointment with your doctor, you speak to your pal that did a medical role play. And that's almost as good, I've found.
Uh-huh.
And they can usually write an illegal prescription as well.
If they've done the vet role play, that's especially good because they'll know when it's time. We'll just have to put you down.
Well, Jane DeBar, a good pal of all of ours, she diagnosed my gallbladder because she'd just done a medical role play on it the week before. So there you
really?
Go. She didn't remove it, but she did diagnose it.
You know how dogs are really good at diagnosing things? You know, they'll just lie.
That's true.
Totally, because last night I was in watching the telly and Dweezil lay on my belly, and as soon as he lay on my belly, I realised I needed the toilet. It was weird.
Wow. I think it's incredible that they can train a dog to smell cancer.
That thing on Netflix about dogs was absolutely amazing. The dog that's trained to know when you're going to have a seizure.
Uh-huh.
Amazing, absolutely amazing.
We did the dog show last year in Glasgow and they had Canines for Heroes, and these were dogs that went with soldiers and personnel that had PTSD,
mm-hmm.
and it could sense when they were going to have a nightmare and it would wake them up due to the hormone that's created.
That's amazing.
That 8-part series you were talking about, Paul, I could not believe the last episode when they actually interviewed a dog.
That's right, I remember it, aye.
Remember that? Mm-hmm. You feel under a lot of pressure? Yes. What do you like to eat? Sausages.
No, my favourite one was the Littlest Hobo one, which was just a dog boop, boop, boop about the village. just wandering, and they just followed it.
The only difficulty with getting dogs to diagnose things is it always turns out it was the amusement park caretaker that gave you the cancer.
That's right, That's exactly right.
I don't know.
Can I just speak up for nurses here as well? Because I've got two friends that are nurses and they're quite senior nurses now, and they've both had complaints put in about them over the years from doctors because they didn't know their place, because they didn't agree with the doctor when they'd worked for many, many, many years in, say, palliative care or whatever. So that's an issue. And both times it was a junior doctor who put in the complaint about somebody who'd been doing the job for 30 years and said nicely, I'm not sure if that is the right way to go
There's
forward.
There's definitely a hierarchy there, and I don't know if it's ego-driven or whatever, but what I didn't realise until somebody told me recently, that when you're a doctor and you become a consultant, you go from being Dr. so-and-so to Mr. or Mrs. so-and-so.
It depends on your discipline.
What's that about?
If it's a surgical discipline, you become Mr. or Mrs. If you are a consultant cardiologist, you're still doctor.
Ah.
They say the difference between God and a consultant, God doesn't think he's a consultant. That's a common nurse's thing.
And the guy, the anaesthesiologist, is that right, Dave?
Aye.
They're always called, always, you can fact check this, Mr. 10, 9, 8.
Yeah.
Fact check.
According to the World Health Organization, the practice is anaesthesiology, the job is anaesthesiologist. In Britain and other Commonwealth countries, anaesthetics and anaesthetists have been used, but that is gradually changing.
Can I tell you a story, though? My friend Karen, who you all know Karen. And
everybody now knows Karen.
Everybody knows Karen. She used to sing in Bucks Fizz and Dollar. Laugh. Anyway, so I've known her from primary one. That's just a wee throw-in for you. And when she was about 20, I think, she went into a hospital called Bon Secours, which was a private hospital, to get her tonsils out. Now, I'd never been in a private hospital in my life, and I didn't know Bon Secours was run by nuns. So I took it in, it was a thing that was just out at the time, and it was a kind of porno book for women. Wasn't full of erections, David.
Why is that aimed at me?
And we're keeping that in and I'm insisting upon it. Anyway, so I went in to visit her. She was sleeping and I left that magazine, but I put another one on top of it so nobody would see. Off I went. I thought, I'll come back the next day and see her, let her sleep. But while she was sleeping, the nurse stroke nun came in and took a couple of magazines to read. Karen had never known during her time in hospital that that magazine was even there. But what she did know was, from that moment, the kindly nuns who were very attentive until that point turned into nuns from hell. They wouldn't even give her a paracetamol. She said they would tuck when they walked in the room and shake their head like she was a filthy lady. And none of it was her fault, all of it mine.
I had my appendix taken out when I was about 12, and the man came the night before. And he says, right, tomorrow here's what's going to happen. And he drew away a pen. He said, here's what we're going to cut. And then I woke up after the appendix had been taken out, and they'd shaved only half of my pubes.
Oh,
and,
no.
And then my pals came to visit me in the hospital, and they left a pile of scud books at the bottom of the bed, but I couldn't get out of the bed because it was too sore. And so that was it. They just left and ran away and left a pile of scud books at the bottom of the bed. Very popular, wasn't that word?
See, the difference, you were popular.
I think that I should spin the stolen alloy of destiny, if that's all right.
Yes.
Here we go, folks.
There we go. It might be Tasmania, you never know. It might not be Australia.
Here's hoping. Fingers crossed.
Goodness me.
It's Dundee.
Dundee.
Now, what's happening in Dundee, Paul?
Well, the silvery tea, it runs from Perth to Dundee all day. And we are going to be there. We're going to be there on the 12th and 13th at Dundee Rep in 2021, everybody.
Don't bother yourself with the 12th, Paul.
We don't want to talk about it in general, but the 12th is already sold out.
Oh.
Wow.
So we'll be there for 2 days. So you might even catch us in the street for a roll in mince. Yes, David.
Lovely.
The road in the miles to Dundee, also very similar to the streets of Laredo.
With a population of 1,487,500. We would certainly hope to sell out the 13th as well.
That's great.
I was looking at some of the people, of course, from Dundee, and the kind of famous, you know, Liz McColgan, Dundonian, her and her daughter, both athletes. Brian Cox.
Yeah, of course.
You see that in Succession when he went back?
In Succession, yeah. Fantastic. Oh. I didn't know this, but does anyone know who Pat Page was?
No.
No. Pat Page was a magician, and he appeared on Paul Daniels' magic show. He was also an advisor to Derren Brown. Tales of the Unexpected, did all the kind of magic stuff and that. When he died, the president of the Magic Circle gave him the ultimate compliment. Can we guess what the ultimate compliment was from the president of the Magic Circle? What did he say about Pat Page?
Pure magic.
So it's no now you see him, now you don't.
He was the magician's magician.
There you go.
He used to do covert classes for professional magicians in Holborn in London. He would show you all the stuff that you don't know. He was heavy duty.
It's the same as Jerry Sadowitz, is it? No, he's totally revered amongst the magic circle. So our good friend Ronnie McCann, his son, Aidan, is 8, 9 years of age, and he's now a magician. And eventually Ellen DeGeneres got a hold of him and says, you need to come on the show. So he went on the Ellen show, and he'd done like 2 or 3, and then he went to Vegas, and he's a magician in Vegas now, and it was just mental. And then one of the producers says, we really like Aidan and we'd love to use him in some capacity. And Ronnie, being from the south side of Glasgow, as quick as a flash went, well, we've got this brilliant idea called Aidan's Magic Corner, right? And he says, and I can see Aidan looking up at me going, Dad, what are you talking about? And he just went, so what it is we get all these famous folk to come in and Aidan's Magic Corner, and he'll perform magic to them. If you go on YouTube, you can see it right now. I watched it last night. Aidan with Colin Farrell doing magic to him. It was just Ronnie McCann, a wido from Glasgow, on the hoof. The same Ronnie McCann who gave a shout out to everybody from Wemyss Bay.
Hey! That's Weems Bay, everybody. I'm going to ask the question, see if anybody knows who this is. It's the world's worst something. He's from Dundee. His name is Wally McGonagall.
William Topaz McGonagall. He gave himself his middle name. Fact check! McGonagall did not choose the middle name Topaz. He received a letter purporting to be from King Tubar Min of Burma In it, he was informed that the king had knighted him as Sir Topas McGonagall, Grand Knight of the Holy Order of the White Elephant. Despite the letter being an obvious hoax, McGonagall would refer to himself in advertising as Sir William Topas McGonagall, Knight of the White Elephant, for the rest of his life. My Dundee thing relates back to our experts thing,
uh-huh.
and also William Topas McGonagall.
Uh-huh.
So take that. Now, I'm going to read you something. Be prepared that this is very sad.
Oh, right.
Okay. Beautiful railway bridge of the Silvery Tay. Alas, I am very sorry to say that 90 lives have been taken away on the last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time. O ill-fated bridge of the Silvery Tay, I now must conclude my lay by telling the world fearlessly, without the least dismay, that your central girders would not have given way. At least many sensible men do say, had they been supported on each side with buttresses. At least many sensible men confesses.
Yeah, you always go a step further than me, David. World's worst poet.
It's also known as the Ode to Balfour Beatty.
It was Sir Thomas Bouch that designed the bridge, and in terms of experts, he had advice from three structural engineers, but went for another bit of advice from, I mean, you can see how this would easily happen when you're building a bridge, from the Astronomer Royal, every life on board lost. And my friend Angus, who is alive, I think, he was born because his great-grandfather, who was on that very train, was chucked off at Taypor for being pished.
Oh, happy days.
Wow. Are you going to fact-check if Angus is still alive, David?
Well, I haven't heard, he hasn't replied to my email, but I'm hoping he's still alive.
You might want to fact-check this, Dave. Dundee was where Mary Shelley first started putting together her thoughts for Frankenstein.
Ooh.
Coxie, you buying that?
I don't know.
Having been in the Overgate shopping centre in the 70s, I could relate to that. Fact-check! Mary Shelley stayed in Dundee from 1812 to 1814 and did not begin writing Frankenstein until on holiday on the shores of Lake Geneva in 1816. There is no mention of Frankenstein being considered any earlier than this, although her stay in the city of Dundee is mentioned in her foreword of the 1831 edition of the novel Frankenstein.
General Ulysses Grant's visit to Dundee, and he came and he was a bit dismissive, but what he did say is, one quote was, well, it's a... He said it in an American accent. I'll say it in an American accent. Hang the cost. He said, it's a mighty big bridge for such a little town.
Oh.
City of jute, jam and journalism.
Yes.
The DC yes. Thompson. Yes, City of Discovery. We've got the V&A. Great, loads of stuff to do in Dundee, actually. It is weird, though, when you get difficult news. We've all had that. How you react. And I think, as an actor, if you were to get that scenario in a script, you wouldn't expect to react the way that you do.
Do you mean that if you were appearing as a character in Holby City and the doctor comes in and says, oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. McAlpine, you've got 3 months to live, that it'd be inappropriate for you to start laughing? Because that's what you do. Very much that's your kind of default thing. Yeah. You can't help yourself. When you get nervous,
if I feel
laugh.
If I'm scared.
It's probably a bad thing to have in a drama.
It'd be terrible,
probably.
But you see,
that's not uncommon.
Oh, it's very common, truth. Yeah.
What's the bare naked ladies line? I'm the kind of guy that laughs at a funeral.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a very common thing, that I think, anyway.
Whenever it gives me bad news, if a doctor gives me bad news, I automatically do lines that I've heard in American movies. God damn, doctor, say it isn't so.
I had a friend who was getting part of his kidney removed, and the consultant said it was brilliant. So he went home and looked him up on Google to see all the great reviews. Oh, newspaper cuttings and tribunals. Errors, suspension. And this guy was just back at work, so he was quite scared. And one of his operation, he goes in and the consultant's in. Oh, good morning, good morning. He draws where he's going to do all the stuff and goes out. And a minute later, hello, can I come in? Yes, wee guy in a suit comes in. I take it Mr. So-and-so's been in to talk to you, yeah. Did he draw on you? Yeah. Can I have a wee look? So he looks at where he's drawn on him and takes out a chart and compares it with his chart. Okay, that's fine, thanks. Bye-bye. And anaesthetic. Terrified.
Jeez, oh.
I'm always fascinated with the stories of things getting left in people.
Oh, yes.
Phones and a shoe.
Were you always terrified that you would wake up, but you wouldn't actually, you couldn't speak, you couldn't move, but you would be awake during your surgery and you could feel the pain? You would think you died and they'd take you to the morgue, but you wouldn't really be dead. I used to be terrified of that as well.
And then you're in the coffin, going into the crematorium and you're banging in the lid. Yeah, it happens.
Kids would tell you stories when you're young, and when they dug up the body, there was nail marks, scratches on the inside. The legend, remember? Oh, I'd lie in bed worried sick.
But they moan as well, don't they? In the morning.
Oh, they're always complaining.
Shut up, you're dead.
Well, my friend John said that when he was training to be a nurse, that somebody actually, and they were dead, but he'd gone in to just sort of take the body down to the morgue, and he said they half sat up because there was so much wind. This is what will happen to me. There's so much wind in the body.
So here's a doctor for you, Dr. Ian Paisley. Sadly, no longer with us, right? So I had a wee look at Dr. Ian Paisley yesterday. He got an honorary doctorate of divinity from Bob Jones University in South Carolina. I'm wondering, how does that come about? So I phoned them yesterday. I phoned the university and I said, I want to put my child through your college, but they're Roman Catholics. What's your policy in that? And then she said, I don't really know. You'd have to look on the website. And I was like, right, okay. I said, how much is it a year? And it is, in fact, folks, $14,300 per year to go through the Bob Jones University in South Carolina. So don't say I'm not doing my homework for this show.
How much would it cost just to get a doctorate? I know that Dr. Gillian McKeith got her from, I think it was Carolina. When you ask them to read her PhD paper, they won't produce it for anyone. Fact check! Gillian McKeith received her doctorate via distance learning from the non-accredited American Holistic College of Nutrition, later changed its name to the Clayton College of Natural Health in Birmingham, Alabama. It has since closed. As a matter of interest, science correspondent Ben Goldacre managed to register his dead cat for the same qualification. Yeah, I think you could probably get yourself a doctorate just by writing away and saying, give me a doctorate. Save yourself 14 grand. Dr. Paul Riley, that'd be good. Yeah. What you can do, Paul, is just say you're a surgeon and you're Mr. Paul Riley.
Aye. Guess what? I've got a star named after you for your birthday.
Really? As long as you change your name to C7512.6.
Over the years, I've had quite a lot of contact with different doctors at different times, and with my mum and dad and with the kids and myself. And I have to say that I've always had a good experience, and they've always treated my mum and dad really well and with great respect and kindness. And I do think that they should get a wage rise. Of course I do. And, you know, they're talking about teachers and doctors and nurses. That's absolutely fine. But I'd like to say, what about carers? So the carers have been the people, especially in nursing homes, but also going round people's houses. 88% of people who have died from this have been pensioners, and so many in a nursing home. Mm-hmm. So you're going in, you're putting yourself at risk. You're also the only people that are with those folk when they die, because their families can't get in. You're on minimum wage or pretty near it. And if you get the illness or you're off, you are on statutory sick pay. And I haven't heard anybody talking about carers getting a wage rise.
No.
So everybody's out clapping for everybody on a Thursday night. But that's surely where we would start with them. And then we'll talk about teachers and doctors and nurses, of course. But I don't understand why they've been ignored when they have had the brunt of
it
all.
Because it's all about optics. In general, it's fantastic. If the health service weren't fantastic, we'd all be dying, you know? So we accept in general it's fantastic. But just now, politically, someone says anything about hospitals doing things wrong, Prime Minister, someone stands up and says, NHS is full of heroes, and, you know, it taps into something. So care workers don't have that public image. I mean, I think the public love them, but politically, it's much more expedient to praise the NHS and forget about these poor people who have got 15 minutes in somebody's house and then they've got to get somewhere else and they're getting paid a pittance to run round the place. So, like so many things, Jane, they're disposable politically.
Of course, they weren't getting the PPE. They weren't the PPE.
There's no time to PP. No time at all.
They weren't getting the PVA to stick and stuff. None of that.
They weren't getting the PVA, and then they were the first people, the care homes, to be thrown under the bus. Nobody taking any responsibility, blaming the people that were doing their absolute best.
I'm not having a go at them, but, you know, the current UK government, one of their scientific advisors was meant to be England's chief nurse, Ruth May. She was going to come in and take over from Valance at points and Whitty and such like. And they had a dry run. And one of the things they did was they asked her about Dominic Cummings and his trip to Barnard Castle. She said, well, you know, you shouldn't have done it. And And then she got a wee text saying, it's okay, don't bother coming to the press briefing.
Jeez.
When the journalist said, we thought the chief nurse was going to be here. No, no, she's stuck in traffic.
Wow.
Interesting, isn't it? The things that come out from under the rug. And Americans do the same thing just now. Fauci, who's a very respected, six presidents that guy's served, are now briefing against him because he's not holding up with the inject Dettol into your toenails and shine a heavy torch up your arse.
No, it's crazy, man. That,
that must be very difficult for anybody standing beside
Oh,
Trump.
I see. I think you meant shine a torch up your arse, well.
You probably get quite a slim mag light nowadays.
Deborah Burks, that woman's body language when he was when he was chatting to her about disinfectant and how he could inject it. And I've never seen anyone clench and unclench their knees so rapidly and so painfully.
That's right. It went all the way down to your toes. Jane, talking about carers there. I used to live with a family, which you two guys would know. And Phyllis, God rest her, she was 93, I think, maybe a wee bit older than that. And the carers used to get her up in the morning and wash her and then put her to bed at night and stuff. We were sitting in the garden one day and I went, Phyllis, why don't you pick a horse and I'll go and put a horse on for you? And she went, I've not put a horse on for years. My husband loved the horses. And so she opened the newspaper and she picked this horse. And this is where the confusion began because the horse was called Abandoned. And I went, oh, Abandoned. And she went, oh, is it? Oh, well, it doesn't matter then. I'm going, no, no. I'm saying, no, no, no. The horse is called Abandoned. The horse has been abandoned. No, no, no. The horse is called, it's called Abandoned. She went, oh, right. So the horse is still running. I went, well, if we can get to the bookies in time, I went, right, how much do you want me to put on for you? And she went, put a shilling on for me.
Oh.
And the two of us just burst out laughing. And she went, well, it has been a long time. So anyway, I put a fiver on for her. And no, thing only won. She had a wee cup, a wee mug of money. And then we would just back horses every other day until, of course, she ran out of money.
Which is very unusual with betting. It very rarely ends that way.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
You ran out of money and she attacked you with a hammer.
When my dad was in hospital, so my mum wasn't even that confused then, a bit muddled, and he landed up in the Royal, which is what everybody says in Glasgow. You don't go in, you land up in the hospital. And there was a sign up and it said, two to bed. And my mum complained because my dad wouldn't want to share a bed. Now, that's honest truth.
I went to visit my wee Auntie Mary in Dublin and... she was in the hospital, and you know how at the end of hospital visits here, at least used to be, there would be a wee bell?
Yeah.
That would yes.
be the end of the visit. So the wee bell happened in Dublin. Nah, wasn't the end of visiting. It was Mass. I was like, oh no, I'm going to be trapped in Mass.
My mum went in the hospital. It was a hysterectomy, and my dad, who... you know, listeners don't, he was my stepdad, but he's my dad as far as I'm concerned. So they'd not been married long and he wasn't that good in his own in the house, but he thought, I would, she can't be in hospital with all the hospital food. I'll sort her out. He made his version of spaghetti, put it in a flask and took her into hospital, a flask of spaghetti and a bottle of red wine. And put her at a table and place a hand on the shoulder from a nurse. Take that and get out.
I'm sure that features in an episode of The Sopranos.
I know it's good, it's flexible, you can visit people at different times, but the relief of hearing the bell and having to pretend that you have to go now.
Yeah. But
there's no bell and there's no end and the person's tired, you're tired, there's nothing to say.
Exactly.
You feel guilty if you don't stay long. Oh, I miss
it's
the bell.
It's kind of reminiscent to the current situation where you say, what's happening? What have you been up to? And you're like, nothing.
Nothing.
You know what I mean?
Lynn's mum's got a fantastic way of doing that. This is for visiting her house as well. But when she was in hospital for a few days, you're up to visit and she gives you about a wee bit of time. When she's bored of it, she'll say, so, what are you up to now? I like that. It's like a bell.
Yes.
Bring back the bell. No, the belt. Bring back the belt.
Yeah. That'll sort them out, nurses.
That'll cure you.
Aye.
When we were filming Still Game in the City Chambers, they had to get a stuntman in for a fall. And I said, I'm perfectly happy to do this. No, we need a stuntman. Okay, fine. So there's a guy dressed as Winston and me dressed as Winston. Mm-hmm. And they say, just get chatting away to him. what's been your favourite gig then? I says to him, well, he said, I'm actually Daniel Craig's stuntman on all the Bond movies. And I went, no chance. He went, no, he said, I am. And I looked him up and he's Pirates of the Caribbean, all the Bond, everything. And then he shows up for one day on Still Game.
Amazing.
And he asked for a suggestion of beans with his breakfast.
Nice. Ella Henderson would like to know, if you weren't actors, what would you be?
I'd love to have been a rock star.
You are a rock star, Paul.
Thank you very much, David. You cross them in and I just heady them into the back of the net, right?
I guess I'm a teacher as well, so if you weren't...
I couldn't be a teacher.
I do genuinely love doing it sometimes, but not all the time. Oh, Mark, what would
I've
you be?
I've got a lot of pals who are teachers, but I wouldn't have the patience.
Yeah, I think a teacher's a great profession for people and they give a lot back. I find that awful serious and it's quite a lot of work. I would quite like to be a private eye.
I hadn't even thought about that.
I really, really would like. I get fed up with that and be 25 stone before the year was out.
Just sit in cars,
hamburgers.
No. You don't sit in a car. You buy a black cab and you sit in that. So it's tax deductible. Yes. And when things get boring, you can take a wee hire.
That's an idea.
And the target never knows because they just think it's a taxi.
And you'll hear as well. If you get folk in the back, you'll hear all sorts of stuff.
Aye. There you go.
Where are you off to, Governor? That's what you can say when people get in the back.
I had that Boris Johnson in the back once.
Yep.
Useless.
Okay.
Now, Boys in Green, and it's spelt with an H, make of that what you will. When returning to filming the new series of Still Game, did it immediately feel like it had during the original series, or was it like embarking on a whole new project?
Well, I think because at the same time we had done the Hydro, so it wasn't like we hadn't been away, we were still in each other's company, so it didn't really feel like it was a new project as such. You were just getting into the same costumes and going back into the Klansman.
It was different in the sense that right away I noticed that technically it was very different.
Oh, that's right.
The high definition was there. Right. There was lots of different things like that, but the premise of it was exactly the same, I suppose, wasn't it? So
everybody
knew each other, same makeup girls, same director, very familiar.
Paul's right, I think because we had done the Hydro, I think if we hadn't done that, it would have felt quite strange, and it was a different world. There was loads of social media content, there was pictures getting taken all the time. If you weren't getting used on set, you'd be getting taken over somewhere to get photographs. Yeah, that felt different, but the fact that it was just all of us playing those same characters.
Because it was the BBC who made it this time as well, I got a blue tick. I didn't know what a blue tick was.
Yeah, on Twitter,
And they were like, well, we're going to give you a blue tick. And it's basically somebody validating your parking. I don't know what difference it makes.
That's the kind of thing that Mark had in his arse when he was a child.
That's exactly. Yeah. They got us all a blue tick, but I think they get you a blue tick predominantly so that you can belong to them.
It's a verifiable account as well, because anyone can set up an account as Paul Riley or Mark Cox and start punting stuff, which of course the BBC were very worried about.
Which we would never do.
You'd never, ever do that.
We would never put a podcast together.
No.
They should have given you a blue tick to a reliable member of the public.
Exactly.
The one thing I would say that was different, we went down to the River City set, which we'd never been to before. And then when we had the character Sheathing, who's supposed to look like the Grim Reaper, we had to share the canteen with all the River City people.
Yep.
Now, Paul, you tell this story.
Right. So Sheathing, a.k.a. Bruce Morton, he's dressed as the Undertaker and he's sitting in the River City canteen, which we're sharing at Una McLean, who's in River City. She would be in her 80s, I would say. And she says to the producer of River City, who's that guy over there? What's he playing in River City? And of course, Bruce is dressed as the Undertaker with the hat on and everything, having his lunch. And the producer said, there's nobody there.
It's terrible.
Right, well, I think that's everyone covered. Thanks very much for listening, folks. And remember to subscribe if you enjoy it. And if you don't enjoy it, then tell other people it's great. Just lie to them. If you want to ask any questions or get in touch with us with ideas, our Twitter handle is 3Down1Across. And we shall catch you all next week. Goodbye.
Yay!
3Down1Across is an Osprey production. This episode was recorded remotely under the law of diminishing returns. It was produced at SoundsMove Facilities.